Hello, listeners, and welcome back to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real courtroom drama. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend. And before we get deep into today's episode, I want to apologize. As many listeners have noted, I skipped a few episodes. The reason for that is I've been on trial in federal court in the Southern District of New York. It was a long and time-consuming affair. But in my line of work, when a trial hits, everything else gets put on the back burner because the client expects and is owed complete and undivided attention. But I do want to say thank you for those of you who reached out when you noticed that the time for a new episode had come and gone with no show. But rest assured, I am back, and we are picking up right where we left off. I would also like to take this opportunity to congratulate my wife, Serena, for joining the law firm of Townsend, Mottola, and Uris, TMU Law. I've known Adam Uris and Larry Mottola for many years, and I'm very excited that my wife was able to join a team of hardworking and zealous advocates. I look forward to seeing and enjoying their successes. In doing the show, sometimes we talk about topics which aren't really suitable for children, just based on the nature of what certain people are alleged to have done in their lives. Once in a while, then the actions are graphic or egregious. And I caution listeners against playing the episode out loud if there are children nearby. And this is going to be one of those episodes. So if you're playing this in a car or out loud with children in the vicinity, you may want to switch to headphones or come back to it later, because we're going to be discussing some subject matter that's perhaps not appropriate for the very young. Okay, with that said, let's get into today's case. Many people will recall that on July 6, 2019, famously wealthy financier Jeffrey Epstein was arrested by federal agents on allegations that he sexually abused a number of minors. If you're a fan of the show, you'll know from previous episodes that in the federal system, when an individual is arrested and is asking for bail, the judge has two things to consider. First, is this person a flight risk? Second, is this person a danger to society? Because of how this story unfolded, everyone knows that Jeffrey Epstein was denied bail. He was remanded and kept in a federal detention center pending his trial. Now, that trial obviously never took place. On August 10th, 2019, Jeffrey Epstein was found dead in his cell. The official cause of death was ruled a suicide, but many conspiracy theories still abound. Epstein was noted for traveling in the most elite circles. He counted several former presidents and foreign royalty as friends. He had amassed a fortune that is nearly incomprehensible. He owned estates and even islands. Needless to say, powerful people who have powerful friends and engage in criminal or corrupt behavior often know things about other powerful people, which they may take actions to keep hidden. But this episode isn't about whether Jeffrey Epstein killed himself or whether it was some elaborate conspiracy to have him assassinated before he could provide information on others. This episode isn't about the secrets that Jeffrey Epstein took to his grave about the rich and powerful elites of the world. In fact, this episode isn't about Jeffrey Epstein, at least insofar as Epstein was never actually put on trial for the conduct relating to his 2019 arrest. This episode is about his partner, his sometime romantic interest, the keeper of his various estates, and his alleged procurer of minor children for abuse, the woman who held his closest confidence, and the woman who, according to her lawyers, would be the proxy for all of society's rage against Epstein for having the temerity to die before justice could be served. This is The United States versus Ghislaine Maxwell. One of the things I find most fascinating about talking to people about the prosecution of Ghislaine Maxwell is the disparity in information known to virtually everyone between Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. Now, most people can tell you that Epstein was a money man, that he owned a townhouse in New York, a huge estate in Palm Beach, a ranch in New Mexico, and even a Caribbean island. They know he was previously arrested for an incident involving a minor, but that basically nothing serious really happened with it. He got a light sentence. They know he's friendly with the Trumps and the Clintons, and that Prince Andrew spent a lot of time with him. That he had his own plane, which earned the nickname the Lolita Express. Most people know he was in finance, that he was an advisor and made a lot of famous people even more wealthy. And most people know that he was supposed to be on suicide watch, but that the corrections officers charged with keeping an eye on him were famously negligent when he died, and then tried to falsify their records to make it seem like they were doing their job. But when you ask people what they know about Ghislaine Maxwell, most people will say she was a British socialite and she was associated with Jeffrey Epstein. That seems to be more or less the beginning and the end of what most people know about her. So who really was Ghislaine Maxwell? How did she find herself prosecuted for conspiracy to entice minors to travel to engage in illegal sex acts, coercion or enticement of a minor female, conspiracy to transport minors with intent to engage in criminal sexual activity, sex trafficking conspiracy, sex trafficking by force, fraud, or coercion, and perjury? Maxwell was born on Christmas Day, 1961, in France. As much as she's known for being a British socialite, she actually held citizenship in the United States, the United Kingdom, and France. She was the youngest of nine children born to Elizabeth and Robert Maxwell, though 2 days after her birth, one of her brothers was involved in a car accident, which left him in a coma for years, until he unfortunately passed away in 1967. During her childhood, her family lived in Oxford, England. She went to fancy boarding schools and did the things that the top of British society did in the 60s and 70s. She was extremely close with her father, who ran a media company out of their 53-room Oxford mansion. Robert Maxwell had risen from extreme poverty in a Czechoslovak Jewish settlement after most of his family were murdered during the Holocaust. He became a British Army war hero, a publishing magnate in England, a Labour Party member of Parliament, and ultimately the owner of the Daily Mirror, one of the United Kingdom's largest newspaper franchises. Maxwell's father also set her up with a number of jobs early in her career. Most notably, he bought the New York Daily News in 1991 and sent Maxwell to New York as his representative. She left and came in January of 91. A few months later, in May of that year, Robert Maxwell left for Russia on a business trip. The next time Ghislaine Maxwell saw her father was after his dead body had been fished out of the water near the Canary Islands in November of 1991. He was floating in the sea near his yacht, which he had named the Lady Ghislaine. Being Jewish, Robert Maxwell was buried in Israel, and his funeral was attended by both the Israeli president and prime minister, who actually delivered the eulogy. After her father's death, Maxwell continued to live in New York, off a trust her father had set up. She was living in an apartment which overlooked Central Park, and was enjoying life as a New York City socialite. There's a bit of mystery surrounding exactly when Maxwell was introduced to Jeffrey Epstein. According to Epstein's former business partner, Stephen Hoffenberg, they met in the late 1980s. Other sources claim it was the early 1990s. For our purposes here, it doesn't really matter. All that's important is that Maxwell met Epstein when she was somewhere around 30 years old, and he was in his mid to late 30s. The two had a romantic relationship, but over the nearly 30 years from their relationship meeting to Epstein's death, they became much more than just dating partners. Starting early on, Maxwell was a prominent feature in many aspects of Epstein's life. She could hire or fire staff at any of his residences. She was often a gatekeeper of his schedule, and she was frequently seen at his side at social events. This arrangement was largely constant through the years until around 2008, when Epstein was convicted of soliciting a minor for prostitution and served a 13-month jail sentence in Florida. We don't really have the time in this episode to really dig deep into that case, but all signs point to the prosecutors having very strong evidence of several instances of egregious sexual misconduct with multiple minors, but quietly resolving the charges with a single instance of solicitation rather than a substantive sex act. The prosecutor at the time was Alex Acosta, who later would become President Trump's Secretary of Labor, until the details of this particular plea deal became public and forced his resignation. After Epstein was released from the Florida jail, Maxwell was really not seen publicly with him. She was still reported to be a fixture in his life, but was not photographed at the extravagant affairs that the two had previously always attended together throughout the 1990s, though she was very much still a socialite in her own right. For about 25 years, Maxwell lived a sort of whimsical life in New York City. After the death of her father in 1991, she had a fairly considerable trust and inheritance, which allowed her the freedom to be professionally wealthy and gave her a sense that she was untouchable. Her actions had no consequences. She was essentially free to do whatever made her happy whenever she pleased. And this facade began to first fall in 2015. In January of that year, a woman named Virginia Giffray filed a lawsuit accusing Maxwell and Epstein of trafficking her around 1999 when she was a minor. The allegations caused a firestorm. Giffray publicly accused Maxwell of grooming her for sexual abuse from Epstein and others, including Prince Andrew, the Duke of York. While rumors had long privately circulated about Epstein, publicly, nobody was really saying a word as Epstein kept making rich people richer. And without proof, the elite circles of society could just shrug off the whispers. But Giffray had a photo, and it showed her at 16 years old, upstairs at Maxwell's NYC townhouse, with Prince Andrew's arm around her, and Maxwell standing a few feet behind them, smiling. The photo and the lawsuit forced the general public to start taking the accusations seriously. After that, many other civil lawsuits followed, all accusing Maxwell of participation in horrific acts of sexual abuse against minor girls. In some cases, she was accused of fully participating in the sexual abuse with Epstein. In others, she was accused of selecting the victims, preparing them, lowering their defenses, and encouraging them to succumb to the abuse. When the 2015 lawsuit by Giffray was filed, Maxwell went into hiding. Her lawyers first claimed that she'd relocated to London, but that they did not know exactly where she was. Later on, they would not even commit to knowing what country she was in. Many judges permitted service of the newer lawsuits by various alternative means because no one was able to find her to hand her the papers directly. In 2016, while in hiding, it appears that she married a man by the name of Scott Borgerson. Borgerson has denied that the two actually got married and claims that Maxwell is just an old friend. Now let's take a brief moment to discuss the procedure which follows when the Department of Justice files an indictment against a person. If you listened to the episode on drug cartel queen Griselda Blanco, we discussed the federal indictment process, but here's a quick refresher. When a person is accused of a federal crime, typically what happens is that the FBI first conducts an investigation, and then contacts the United States Attorney's Office for the district in which the alleged crime took place. The FBI and the attorneys for the Department of Justice sit down and discuss what the FBI investigation uncovered, what witnesses have been interviewed and will cooperate, and what evidence has been secured. It is important to note at this point, usually the Department of Justice will not tell the FBI to go out and arrest the person. First, the Department of Justice lawyers will convene a grand jury. They will present the evidence that the FBI has gathered and secure an indictment, which will be filed in the federal district court under seal. This means that the person who has just been indicted will not know that there is a case pending against them. Once the indictment has been filed under seal, the FBI then will locate and arrest the individual, and the indictment will be unsealed once they are brought to court and be arraigned. Then the case becomes public. The goal behind keeping the indictment sealed prior to the arrest is that the government does not want the person who they are accusing of a crime to know that they are being investigated and flee the jurisdiction as a result. So everything is done in secret until the Department of Justice is ready to proceed with the case. Well, you may be asking yourself, if the Department of Justice is so concerned with keeping everything secret, then why not just arrest the person, take them into custody, and then get an indictment from the grand jury afterwards? And the chief reason for this is speedy trial time. Convening a grand jury, then actually presenting evidence to them, and securing an indictment, and then filing it, can sometimes take a bit of time. That period of time is chargeable against the government in calculating its speedy trial time limit. If there's already a secured indictment, then no time is expelled for this process. And the government, as you'll remember, has 70 days of chargeable time from the arraignment to conduct the trial. And again, if you want to get a much deeper look at this incredibly important but frequently overlooked issue of speedy trial time, go back to the episode on Griselda Blanco and listen to that. So let's get back to Maxwell. She's gone off the grid since 2015, and it's fairly likely that her civil attorneys at the time advised her that based on the nature of the allegations in the Giffray civil suit, she was likely under federal investigation for federal crimes. She was famously discovered living in New Hampshire at the home of Scott Borgerson. In July 2020, a phone call from her lawyer was tracked by the FBI to a woman who had been living under the name Jen Marshall in a secluded New Hampshire mansion belonging to Borgerson. Federal agents wasted no time in raiding the compound, and Maxwell was found there. She was brought back to Manhattan as the case against her was brought in the Southern District of New York, which covers Manhattan and is where many of the alleged acts of abuse took place. Her case was assigned to the Honorable Judge Allison Nathan, one of the judges in that district that I respect the most. Judge Nathan is a President Obama appointee and is currently waiting to hear about her nomination to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. She is contemplative, smart, and completely unbiased. She has no problem calling out misconduct and demands strict accountability by the lawyers who practice in front of her. The prosecution team was led by Allison Moe and Laura Pomerantz. The defense team was led by Bobby Sternheim and Laura Menninger. Perhaps because this was a sex trafficking case and the defendant was a female, the most prominent members of each trial team were also women. Over the years, I've been asked many times about whether it matters to have a woman featured on cases of sexual abuse or misconduct. Does a jury pick up on the fact that some woman is willing to make arguments for this particular defendant, and because of that, find the defendant's story to be ever so slightly more credible? The truth is, I'm honestly not sure. I get the argument for it. Typically, sex crimes victims are females, and I think there is possibly an optical disadvantage to having a male defendant and a male defense attorney when cross-examining female victims. That being said, I don't see much value in tokens. Having a woman on a trial team for the sake of having a woman does not add value, and I think jurors see through that rather quickly. Now, Having a capable member of the defense team who also happens to be a woman is always a bonus, and it may even carry additional value in a sex crimes case. But adding a woman for the sake of having a woman probably doesn't make a difference. But Bobbi Sternheim is a nationally renowned lawyer. She's handled a number of complex, serious cases and is known to be an excellent courtroom attorney. So let's take a look at how Maxwell's trial unfolded. In a lot of ways, it went exactly how you would expect it to. But this was a case which was going to be decided in the nuances. It was no secret that Allison Mo's tactic was going to be to tie Maxwell to Epstein. And this was fairly easy to do because Maxwell was charged with conspiracy to entice minors to travel and engage in illegal sex acts. A conspiracy is an agreement among two or more people to accomplish a criminal goal. It's required, then, that the prosecutor show that the defendant agreed with someone else to commit the crime. In this case, that other person was Jeffrey Epstein. Mo and her team wanted to make this case as much about Epstein as it was about Maxwell. The country was left with a profound sense of discomfort and a lack of closure when Epstein was found dead. Just the name, Jeffrey Epstein, provokes a visceral reaction in people. Connecting Maxwell to Epstein would tar her, and the federal prosecutors wanted the jury to view Maxwell with the same moral condemnation that was fixated on Epstein. Epstein himself was not on trial, but his name came up just as often as Maxwell's. In the prosecution's opening statement alone, Department of Justice lawyer Laura Pomerantz used the phrase, "the defendant and Epstein," more than a dozen times. And in a big way, the fact that he was not physically present, the fact that he wasn't the one on trial, made the prosecution's job easier. Epstein had long ago been tried and convicted in the court of public opinion. There was no need to produce proof that Epstein himself did anything wrong. The prosecutors were able to leverage public opinion and allow the jury to take for granted that Epstein was the monster that they alluded him to be, and then by association, claim that Maxwell was the same type of monster. The defense, as you can imagine, wanted to separate Maxwell from Epstein as much as humanly possible. Knowing that Epstein was already guilty in the eyes of the public, Sternheim and her crew wanted to do anything and everything she could to create distance between the disgraced financier and her socialite client. Now, there was abundant evidence that Epstein and Maxwell were close during the time period when the prosecutors alleged these criminal acts took place, just between 1994 and 1997. But Sternheim took every opportunity to drive wedges in where she could. The defense knew that if they attempted to actually defend Epstein in any capacity, that they would lose all credibility with the jury. The only argument to make then was that Maxwell and Epstein briefly dated, she did some work for him, but that was it. Maxwell claimed that she was unaware of his private activities and had no idea that he was a serial child abuser. Sternheim, Menninger, and the entire defense team repeated over and over again that Maxwell was not Jeffrey Epstein, that she was the one on trial, not him, and that the prosecutors were attempting to link the two because they simply didn't have a case against Maxwell on her own. In her opening statement, Sternheim claimed that women had been blamed for the misdeeds of men since Adam and Eve. Now, this was really the only defense available here. Accept what you have to, disclaim what you think you can, and force the government to prove the links that it's making. In that way, this case came down to the jury listening to alleged victims and determining whether they could be believed or if they were making it all up. Sternheim accused the victims of changing their stories over the years in hopes of getting larger and larger portions of a victim's compensation fund set up by Epstein's estate. The prosecution's case revolved around the testimony of four alleged victims. Three testified under pseudonyms, going by Jane, Kate, and Carolyn. Only Annie Farmer, who had publicly filed a lawsuit against Epstein's estate and Maxwell, used her real name. Without going into too much explicit detail about the testimony of the four victims, they each testified predominantly about being abused by Epstein, but each of them described Maxwell's role. To some, she participated in both grooming and to some extent the abuse itself. But in each case, the four women testified that in the late 1990s, when they were each underage, Maxwell was the one who chiefly interacted with them, prepared them to meet with Epstein, sometimes alone, sometimes with her, and the interactions would always result in the girls being sexually abused. The prosecution called other witnesses, but these four were clearly the focus of the entire case. They were emotional, and the testimony was every bit as damaging as the prosecutors hoped and needed it to be. The defense had two arguments, which fit together a little more clumsily than I think was anticipated. Sternheim, Menninger, and the defense team alleged first that the victims were just looking for money. They were seeking financial compensation from Epstein's victim fund, and they were motivated to lie to get paid. One of the victims, the one testifying only as Jane, worked as an actress, and Menninger spent a considerable amount of time attacking her credibility as someone who takes on alternative personas for a living, someone who can cry on demand, and who finds it easy to talk about things that are made up as though they're real. It was an aggressive line of questioning. And that brings us to a very nuanced aspect of trial work, which is cross-examining a sympathetic witness. Every lawyer develops their own personal style of conducting cross-examination, but certain types of witnesses have to be handled differently regardless of the tack you usually take. The approach for cross-examining a police officer who botched his or her paperwork and created an inconsistent account of criminal behavior is very different from cross-examining, say, a mother who's testifying about losing her daughter to a violent crime. When a sympathetic witness is on the stand, especially if that person is an alleged sex crimes victim, there is a very delicate line between drawing out inconsistencies and omissions and quote-unquote victim bashing. And it doesn't matter if the attorney is a man or a woman. If the lawyer is perceived as just dragging a rape or abuse victim through the mud, the jury will turn on them quickly. Even if the victim really is an inveterate liar, you have to be careful about how you expose that. First, you have to get the jury to turn on the witness. Then you can start to tarnish them. But you have to be careful in your tone, your demeanor, and your wording. You have to start out deferential. You can't open your cross-examination with any sort of mockery of the witness's story unless you can immediately tear the whole thing down. Instead, you have to act like you're simply probing for a few more details, just so that you can fully understand the entire story. Then you can slowly start to point out that you're confused about some minor things that don't fully line up. Then you extend that confusion to some other things the witness has said. And for the jury's sake, it's helpful to bring back up certain things the witness can't explain when they should, or inconsistencies that they've admitted to previously, so that the jury is constantly reminded that this person is capable of either lying or at the very least being mistaken. And at that point, it becomes a kind of dance, with the witness and the lawyer each trying to subtly get under each other's skin. Each is trying to provoke a reaction which will alienate the jury. If I can get this type of witness to snap at me over what seems like an innocuous question, then I'll know I'm gaining ground with the jury. When a witness retorts sarcastically or shows flashes of anger, juries will often think that means that the witness is hiding something, and frequently it's because they are. Now let's get back to Maxwell. Her defense team was probably a bit more aggressive early on in the cross-examinations than I would have been. But I do think they were able to get a few good cross points out there with regards to the financial incentives and the plans that all the victims had to try and collect money as compensation for the actions that they testified about. Incentives and motivations are always a big part of witness testimony on cross-examination. If a person has no reason to lie, their testimony is going to seem more credible. If they have some sort of reason to testify a certain way, people will be more skeptical of accepting it as truth. When that motivation is money, especially if it's a lot of money, people will really think twice about it. The financial motivation to claim victim status here was immense, especially since three of the victims did not even have to provide their true names. They could testify under pseudonyms and still apply for relief from the victim compensation fund. The defense team was really counting on that to be a major hit to their credibility. But the four women all stayed consistent, stuck to their stories. There were no epic breakdowns or admissions of fabrication, and they all admitted to hoping to get compensation. They recounted their stories of abuse under exacting scrutiny and emerged as credible witnesses. Now, Maxwell's defense also relied heavily on the testimony of her expert, Elizabeth Loftus. Loftus is a psychology professor at the University of California who specializes in memory. She testified in the high-profile criminal trials of Harvey Weinstein, Robert Durst, and even as far back as Ted Bundy. In her testimony, she told the jury that people can have false memories of traumatic events. She explained that memories don't simply record like a DVR to be accessed with crystal clarity later. Rather, memories, according to Dr. Loftus, are subject to suggestion. A person can see something on the news or read about it in the media and generate memories of events which never happened based on the coverage of that event that the person consumes. By reading accounts of Epstein's abuses, according to Dr. Loftus, it's possible for people to unknowingly conjure up memories of similar events without ever having even met Epstein. Especially if the person learned that certain events took place geographically near where the person was or somehow related to an aspect of life important to that individual. The essence of the testimony was that the memories that the four victims were testifying about were not necessarily accurate, even though the women themselves may not even know it. On cross-examination, Assistant United States Attorney Laura Pomerantz brought up the fact that Dr. Loftus was getting paid $600 an hour for her work on the case, and that she had made a career in testifying for defendants only, calling into question her impartiality. There's a lot that can be said about expert witnesses, and we've discussed them in many different capacities in past episodes. But this is an important thing to always keep in mind when an expert witness is testifying in a case. Is what this person is saying going to move the needle in a significant way on my beliefs about what happened here? Obviously, the party putting on the expert hopes that the answer to that question is yes. But there are times when even if the opposing party doesn't do much to discredit the expert, it really doesn't affect the outcome of the case. Let's look at an example to help clarify what I mean here. If you're a trial junkie, or you follow any major court case litigation, or if, even if you watch a lot of movies that center around court cases, chances are you've heard the phrase battle of the experts. Now, what this phrase means is that each side has retained an expert whose testimony, if accepted, will mean that their side should prevail at court. The experts are necessarily at odds with each other. In criminal cases, this is often seen when the defendant claims an affirmative defense of insanity or self-defense. The defense will put on an expert to say that the defendant should not be convicted because at the time of the commission of the crime, a condition existed which should negate criminal liability, either insanity or a reasonable belief of the need to defend himself or herself. The prosecutor, on the other hand, will find an expert to say that the defendant was either sane at the time of the action or that it was completely unreasonable to think that whatever level of force was used was necessary for self-defense. If the jury credits one expert, it must necessarily discredit the other, and the side with the prevailing expert will win the case. Often, in a battle of the experts type of case, the expert will render the most important testimony at the trial, so a significant amount of time is spent simply preparing the expert to handle every aspect of direct and cross-examination to ensure the best possible chance of being accepted by the jury. But not every case which involves experts revolves so intricately around their testimony. Sometimes they provide clarity to a tangential issue or explain a minor point of contention. And sometimes one party retains an expert to testify about something, and the other side does not even think it's important enough to get their own expert to refute it. Now, this is a risky move, and we saw it backfire pretty spectacularly in the George Zimmerman trial, when the defense put an expert on to provide testimony regarding where George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin were in relation to each other when the gun was fired. The prosecution's lack of an expert to refute that testimony was one of the major reasons, I personally believe, that the jury acquitted Zimmerman of the murder. But there can be strategy to not hiring an expert of your own. It sends a message to the jury that this point is so insignificant that it should just ignore it completely. That was the message by Laura Pomerantz, Allison Moe, and the rest of the prosecution team in the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. When the defense retained Dr. Loftus to speak on memory, the Department of Justice could have hired their own expert to talk about how memories were unlikely to be fabricated, and that four strangers were unlikely to fabricate such similar, intricately detailed memories of events without ever having spoken to each other to compare stories. They could have found an expert to go through the studies that Dr. Loftus testified about and explain why they weren't necessarily as powerful as she claimed. But they didn't. Instead, they treated the testimony like it was garbage, that the jury could just disregard, and that it was so outlandish that it wasn't even worth their time to refute it. During the closing arguments, Allison Moe delivered a direct, pointed synopsis of how the evidence pointed to guilt. She emphasized Maxwell's place in Epstein's life, how close they were, how familiar she was with every particular detail governing how Epstein wanted his residences run. She focused on the similarities between all of the victims' stories to showcase that the corroboration established the credibility of all of the witnesses. She dismissed the defense case as outlandish and contrary to common sense that these abused women could have all accidentally created false memories of the abuse, which were all so closely aligned. The main focus was, of course, on the four women. Moe walked through how the testimony of each one applied to the charges that Maxwell was facing. Sternheim, on the other hand, threw the kitchen sink at the jury. She was less focused and had a less clear narrative. She asserted that Maxwell was innocent of the charges, but the why was more difficult to follow than in Moe's presentation. Sternheim spoke at length about all the reasons that the alleged victims in this case would lie, then discussed Dr. Loftus' testimony that they might not even be lying, but might have just been subject to suggestion and unintentional memory creation through consumption of news media about the unfolding story of Jeffrey Epstein. The trial itself lasted 4 full weeks, and the deliberations took a full 5 days. With the Omicron variant hitting a fever pitch while the jury was deliberating, Judge Nathan asked the jury if they would remain a little longer into the evenings deliberating. a request which the jury declined. Getting more and more nervous as December 31st approached, Judge Nathan told the jury to expect to deliberate on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day if they had not yet reached a verdict. She did not want to risk a COVID-related mistrial and have to start the whole process over again. But at the close of the day on Wednesday, December 29th, 2021, the jury announced that they had reached a verdict. Maxwell was convicted of 5 out of the 6 counts at her trial. She was found guilty of sex trafficking of a minor, transporting a minor with the intent to engage in criminal sexual activity, and 3 counts of conspiracy. She was acquitted of 1 count of enticing a minor to travel to engage in illegal sex acts. As of now, she has yet to be sentenced. But at her age, and based on the charges she has been convicted of, it seems decently likely that she will die in prison if she doesn't win on appeal. In summation, trials have a way of making larger-than-life personalities seem reduced. These people who crafted such extreme public personas are put on trial and are reduced to shells of how they were publicly perceived. We saw this when an elderly Whitey Bulger was put on trial, and witnesses just described him as a mean man who beat them up, who took their money. For all the flamboyance of John Gotti, in his trial, he appeared to be a small, frail, vindictive bully. Scott Peterson seemed less a criminal mastermind and more a philandering, small-minded jerk. Ghislaine Maxwell was reduced from a jet-setting socialite to a weak-minded child molester who voluntarily did the bidding of a puppet master. It was hardly the role the public ever saw her in during the pretrial media coverage of the whole Jeffrey Epstein affair. But that's what trials do. They strip away the media-created extravagance, and they expose the ugly inner truths about what really happened and who people really are. And sometimes we get so fixated on the glory of the criminal underworld and the lavish lifestyles of fictional people who refuse to play by society's rules that we forget that these mobsters and kingpins that we secretly root for on screen would be causing true mayhem if those stories ever played out in the real world. Lives would be ruined, futures destroyed, and all because some people put their immoral desires above the well-being of anyone else. And that's just what Ghislaine Maxwell did. She and Jeffrey Epstein decided to take whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted, from whoever they wanted. And the ruins of destruction they left in their wake didn't bother them at all. They thought they were untouchable, and that they could act with impunity, and nobody could stop them. In my personal opinion, and I don't expect too much pushback in listener emails on this one, Ghislaine Maxwell was going to be found guilty before opening statements in this trial were given. There was virtually no chance that she was going to get acquitted. The most I think she could have ever hoped for was getting one juror to hold out and cause a mistrial. Convincing a full 12 jurors that she was innocent of the charges was a pipe dream. There was too much evidence, too much media coverage. She had long since been tried and convicted in the media. Everyone knew that she fled. Everyone knew that she was hiding off the grid. There were so many news stories, news segments, documentaries put out, which tied Maxwell so intricately with Epstein that the idea that she could somehow escape the taint of his name was never going to materialize. In my opinion, the jury did their job. They got the verdict right. And I actually happen to think there's merit to Dr. Loftz's work on memory issues. But this was not the case to trot that out. There were just too many similarities between the stories. The coincidence of multiple artificial memories being so closely aligned was never going to get any serious traction. Though I understand why the defense argued it. Other than the fact that the witnesses were looking to be compensated for their abuse, there was not much else which could be used to attack their credibility. As a lawyer, sometimes you're forced to make weak arguments simply because you don't have the evidence to make stronger ones. Bobby Sternheim is a good lawyer. She did an admirable job with the limited arguments she had the ability to make. And Allison Moe is no slouch. She did a good job as well. But it's always a bit easier when you have a mountain of evidence and public opinion already on your side. So I don't want to take anything away from her. She tried the case correctly, she made smart arguments, and she refrained from dragging the case on by putting 100 witnesses on the stand. But in truth, I would have been shocked to hear anything other than a guilty verdict in this case at the end of the day. So that's the show on Ghislaine Maxwell, and by proxy, Jeffrey Epstein. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever platform you use to listen. Also remember to check out the show's website, insummation.com, if you haven't already, to listen to previous episodes, see clips of legal commentary I've done, or read up on some articles on issues that have come up in previous episodes that I've written. A special thank you, as always, to my brother and audio engineer, Dan Townsend, who tirelessly upgrades the audio quality while adding his own flourishes where appropriate. I appreciate it. If you want to contact me, you can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Again, I do need to say thank you to everyone who was concerned when the episodes weren't forthcoming because I was on trial. It really means a lot to me that people actually look forward to getting these and enjoy listening enough to reach out. So please keep sending me feedback, suggestions, notes, questions, whatever you want. I especially appreciate the comments and questions from my law student listeners. I'm happy to help out in any way I can with you all. I do intend to get back to a normal schedule at this point, at least until my next trial. So, until the next installment comes out, thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.